The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
What is freedom?
Freedom of speech.
At this point, free speech is nothing more than a nuisance.
Freedom of worship.
Wake up, Christian America. You are being mocked.
Freedom from want.
We would actually go in Walmart and clean ourselves up before we go to
yeah,
school.
Yeah, in the bathroom.
Save some money.
Freedom from fear.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Our Four Freedoms series this week continues with freedom of speech. What was FDR thinking when he called for America to defend freedom of speech at home and abroad back in 1941? Freedom of speech in our time is a bit more complex and we could say entertaining than it was back in 1941. Here's the beauty of free speech American style at the 2015 White House Correspondents' Dinner.
I'm a mellow sort of guy. And that's why I invited Luther, my anger translator, to join me here tonight. Hold on to your lily white butts. In our fast-changing world, traditions like the White House Correspondents' Dinner are important.
I mean, really? What is this dinner? And why am I required to come to it?
Satire, pushing the racial envelope, abuse, and ranting are all features of the free speech we practice in our time. Stephen Thrasher is a senior columnist for The Guardian U.S. He's a practitioner of free speech and a victim of online incivility and vitriol himself. When The Guardian recently analyzed 70 million comments from its website over the past decade to better understand which of the top 10 writers received the most negative comments, 8 were women and the other 2 were black men. Thrasher was one of them.
The number of channels of communication are much more now. They're much wider. When you look back at Roosevelt's era, we're talking about only a few broadcasters, only a few publication outlets. And of course, everything is much wider now. But something that's quite similar is that we always have to wonder whose speech are we talking about? So if you're thinking about it in the 1940s, Roosevelt obviously is not thinking necessarily about the freedom of the speech of the Japanese, for example.
No.
And whose speech is going to be included at the table and permitted to be heard on a wide scale is always going to be a very contested thing, no matter the historical period you're talking about.
Looking at it from the standpoint of there's more speech now and more different kinds of speech now, what do you make of the abusive targeting of people online? Is that something that it's better to have out in the open, reveals something about our society? What do you think?
I have very ambivalent feelings about comments on stories. When I worked at the Village Voice years ago, everything was allowed to be said. And so as I talked about in the Guardian story, you know, people would routinely call me a nigger or a faggot and nobody would take it out of the comments. The Guardian does siphon those comments out. And we looked at 70 million comments over about a decade. And out of 12,000 writers, I was one of the top 10 people to have my comments filtered because people would just say such vitriolic things. And I've certainly learned from talking to particularly women colleagues and women colleagues of color, they can be writing about very uncontroversial things, and yet people will still come at them with these really horrifying things. So as a publication, I don't mind comments getting taken out. I don't see that as a stifling of speech. And I've certainly, in terms of technology, seen that over my career, people have started talking much more through Twitter and through Facebook, which I think those conversations could be more generative because they can be with people you know or sort of people that are in your circle. Everything is going to get out there in some way. Sometimes I will look at sites like Stormfront to see what white supremacists are talking about. And organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center and hate group watchdogs will look at those places and find interesting things. But I don't know that it's always helpful to have that stuff always lobbed at writers of color, gay writers, women writers who are very unlikely to have much free speech because they're highly unlikely to even get journalism jobs in the first place.
That refers to discrimination, which, of course, has the consequence of limiting speech. if it limits the number of people who can actually speak to the nation through journalistic institutions. But there are many other ways to speak to the nation today. Do you think that speech is freer and more open today with these mechanisms, or are we enforcing a kind of politically correct speech that makes it harder to say certain things without getting in all kinds of trouble?
I don't think we're making it harder. People are definitely going on the offense to try to have more speech, and we certainly see ways that it has an effect. The killing of Mike Brown is something that we first learned about through social media. A lot of the police deaths we first learned about through social media. And so they didn't have to go through the filter of journalism to kind of come into the public consciousness. And that's a really important thing. We've also seen through the Black Lives Matter movement activists who are very willing to try to take the microphone from politicians. And I wrote about this last week. When President Clinton is sort of saying his speech is being curtailed when he's being interrupted, I don't think that's a really fair frame. People like President Clinton have had 400 years of having the microphone. And so when an activist tries to also say, hey, you know, we have something to say that's worthy of a wide audience and tries to upstage him, I don't think that his free speech is being curtailed. I think there we're actually seeing democracy in action and seeing competing visions for the country trying to get attention. That was really important speech to get out there. And we can say that it's impolite, that it's not fair, that they should wait their turn. But those people aren't likely going to get their turn unless they very directly confront, you know, somebody in a setting like that. It's a very different thing than when we saw Bernie Sanders actually give the stage to three young Black women who challenged him, which we don't see politicians do very often.
What do you think the free speech challenge is going to be at the two conventions?
There'll be some similarities and differences. At the Republicans, you're going to see, I'm afraid, quite violent demonstrations against people trying to keep these kinds of hateful messages from coming out. You're also going to see a lot of talk about free speech in terms of Trump supporters if there's backroom dealings coming that are trying to take the nomination away from him. At the DNC, they're going to have to figure out how to deal with this insurgency of Black voters and Black activists who want to keep these issues on the table, because the Democratic Party wants to keep these kinds of activists in the fold. They're going to have to find a way to let them be heard, but also to respond in a graceful and interactive way when they are challenged rightly on a lot of these fronts.
Roosevelt intended that the U.S. would enter World War II to fight for freedom of speech in places around the world against the dictators, as he called them, in 1941. What would you say the global, you know, track record is of freedom of speech in light of Charlie Hebdo and some of the issues that constrain speech around the world?
Roosevelt intended, and the Founding Fathers intended, to have a sense of free speech from a very particular sense of themselves and over who was going to be speaking. And that is always challenged in different countries. We have a different sense of satire in the United States than they do in France with Charlie Hebdo. It's very different in England and the United States as well. And I think we always need to keep in mind that what we think of as free speech is very linked to our own politics and economics in this country.
But does that mean that freedom of speech should involve the ability to make someone really angry with something that you will do either satirically or otherwise?
Free speech is going to make people angry. I think when journalists are doing it right, it's going to make people in power angry. So it's strange when President Obama will weigh in on the media. It's strange, you know, to hear him say that in a way, because the Edward Snowden leaks were, you know, something that the Obama administration responded to very aggressively in terms of putting Chelsea Manning in solitary confinement and in terms of going very aggressively after people who leak. The Obama administration has gone after people, I would say, as hard as the Nixon administration is to plug leaks in the press. And what is free speech in that way? I mean, free speech is not sort of this crystal clear thing. You can argue about people who work for the government releasing documents. Is that free speech? I think we really needed the Snowden documents to come out. The same thing with the Panama Papers. Things that are secret, journalists need to bring to the fore. And so the United States government will have a project ostensibly of saying that it wants to have more free speech around the world, but it doesn't particularly want the Panama Papers out. It certainly didn't want the Snowden Papers out. And it's very aggressive in trying to keep those kinds of things from coming to the fore.
Would you fight for free speech elsewhere than the place where you live? In other words, is free speech so important that you would put yourself in danger?
I write very openly about my life, and I will deal with the consequences. And that's something that I do as a journalist and many people do as journalists. And I think that we're seeing a really beautiful wave of protesters right now who are putting themselves and their sense of free speech on the line when they do go to a Trump rally and speak out, or when they challenge President Clinton or Secretary Clinton or Senator Sanders. I think that people are sort of putting themselves out there in a particular way. I think it's more admirable not to say we need to go to war with a certain country to expand their free speech. I think it's more important to look at the young transgender people of color who are expressing themselves and expressing their free speech and their protest in states like Mississippi and North Carolina right now, because they're putting themselves in harm's way. And they're not doing it in a way that furthers militarism or economic hegemony. They're doing it in a way that tries to expand American freedom right here within our country.
Stephen Thrasher is a writer at large and senior columnist for The Guardian US. He's a doctoral fellow in American Studies at NYU. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For the people of North Waziristan, Pakistan, drone surveillance and drone attacks are common. Our next guest, Malik Jalal, has experienced so many attacks that he is convinced that he's been put on a US and UK list targeting individuals in Afghanistan and Pakistan. In 2011, after a drone strike killed over 40 people in Waziristan, Jalal, along with other tribal elders of the North Waziristan Peace Committee, stated they would take, quote, blood revenge against Americans. Also, they said they would support suicide attacks. Jalal is in England this week on the invitation of the former director of public prosecutions there to plead for his name to be removed from the kill list. He wants the West to know directly the consequences of drone warfare. And with the translation of his lawyer, Shahzad Akbar, we spoke with Jalal about his situation.
It was back in 2010 when I suspected that I am the target of the drone strike.
How did you know that? What happened that made you feel that it was you who was the target?
It was between Madakhel and Datakhel. These are two villages in Waziristan, and I was traveling from Madakhel to Datakhel, and there was a similar SUV just behind my SUV, same color, same make, and it was targeted right behind me. It blew up the back of my car as well. And the people who died in the other SUV, they were laborers and ordinary people from my village. And then I suspected, because the vehicles were similar, so maybe perhaps I was the target. And later, when I was just amiss in other targets, in other strikes, then I realized that the first one was that one. And then later in other strikes, I was targeted as well.
How many drone strikes do you think have targeted you that you know of?
You know, I have been in... At the scene of many drone strikes, if I remember correctly, it was around 27, 28 drone strikes. But there were about four strikes specifically in which I believe I was the target and I just missed by a few minutes or seconds.
How do you know you're on the list? You say it in your writing as though you know it for sure. Have you seen the list?
Well, I haven't seen the list because it's a secret, and I don't think anyone has seen that list other than few people. After my suspicion, I was confirmed by some Afghans who were coming into our areas, and that I knew because of my position being a very senior Malik and tribal elder in our area. They informed me that Americans are after me and they would like to eliminate me in drone strikes because of my role in North Waziristan Peace Committee and also my strong opposition to their drone strikes and gathering the civilians to fight the legal battle against United States. So all these confirmations just reaffirmed my belief.
I'm just wondering how security let you on a plane to London. I mean, if you're on a kill list, you've got to be on a no-fly list.
I know for sure, I'm 100% sure I'm on some sort of list. And if I'm wrong, U.S. can just tell me I'm not on that list so that I can live in peace. I had no trouble because I had an invitation from United Kingdom by Lord Ken MacDonald. And on that invitation, I was given visa. And then after that, it took a while to get the visa. But once I got the visa and I've come here and I've been received very well by people here and the MPs that I've met. And I'm very thankful to them for that.
What have the drones done to civilian life in Pakistan?
It had a great impact on lives of people in Waziristan because that is where the drones were concentrated over the years. Majority of people in Waziristan are poor people. It became extremely difficult for them to earn their living after the drone war started. There was no trade that was being done because anyone from outside was afraid to come to Waziristan, and so you would not have much trade going on. It had a huge psychological impact on almost everyone, women, children, elderly, adults, by living constantly under that buzzing noise. And it was just like living in an area where you are bound to your houses and you're not even safe there. A lot of people had to migrate out of Waziristan because of the fear and the constant presence of drones. I myself, along with my family, moved 2 years ago out of Waziristan because I was afraid that in order to kill me, they might end up killing my children as well. And my son, he was unable to sleep during the nights and he would not go to school. And every time I'll tell him to go to school, he would argue drones target madrasas and schools as well, so I might get killed, so I can't go to school.
Do you think you have the right to call for suicide bombings to avenge the drone strikes that you've witnessed?
Well, first of all, I really condemn any sort of violence, and I have personally witnessed 27 drone strikes myself where I've gone to the scene and collected body parts. But what really triggered all that was the strike in 2011 on the Jirga, which, other than dozens of people that were killed, four of my colleagues who I grew up with, and they were the senior tribal elders who were negotiating peace between two rival tribes, they were killed and I collected their body parts, and there was an extreme anger among the people of the village and people of those two tribes, and they wanted to avenge and do all sorts of things against Americans. And what I said to them, that you should not cross the border, you should not go there. If there is any revenge to be taken from the Americans, we the elders take upon us to send out any suicide bombers. But this was never the intention. I have never and will never resort to any sort of such violence.
But you threaten to, and people are going to take you seriously if you're from the village elders in North Waziristan. I mean, that's a place where people are pretty active.
I think that is the reason for this all misunderstanding, because that press conference probably was taken very seriously by United States, and maybe that is the reason they put me on the list. Over the time when my feeling of being targeted got confirmed, then I have now come to United Kingdom and I'm bringing a case against United States government as well to take my name out, because I'm presenting myself for any sort of clarification, and it's the United States now that has to come and question me.
Malik Jalal is a leader of the North Waziristan on Peace Committee, who claims to be on a joint U.S.-UK drone kill list. U.S. and U.K. intelligence agencies have yet to respond to our requests to comment on Jalal's claims. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and the golden number for the Golden State Warriors is 73.
It's official number 73. The greatest regular season in NBA history now belongs to the 2016 Golden State Warriors.
That's the new record for NBA games won in a single season, a record held by the 1995-96 Chicago Bulls. Mike Breen with the call there on ESPN. In the final game of the season last night against the Memphis Grizzlies, the Warriors socked away some legend on their way to the playoffs. And Steph Curry got to practice his three-point shots, including this milestone.
Old-fashioned way, as Curry does it. 400 three-pointers in a season.
He finished the game with 402 three-pointers for the season, breaking his own record by 116. Sekou Smith is a sports reporter and senior analyst for NBA Digital at Turner Broadcasting. Sekou, this is like the crazy time. I mean, Warriors, does anyone touch them?
They were so good this season. You win 73 games, first team in the history of the league to do that, and we're talking 70-plus years of history. It's really hard to look around the league and figure out who could, you know, step up and knock them off on their way to a second straight championship.
And this three-point shooting business, I mean, he's channeling something from another galaxy.
I think what it really boils down to is here's a guy who was never really, you know, among those elite players as a young guy, as a teenager, the son of an NBA player, of course. So he grew up around the game, but was never one of those guys who had it handed to him. And you're seeing the, you know, all of the hard work that he's put in come to fruition. And really, his teammates are really locked in and on that same level in terms of work ethic.
So wait a minute. You're telling me that Curry is getting playground revenge with all those threes on an NBA pro court?
I think that has a lot to do with it. He doesn't wear his chip on his shoulder, but there's a competitor inside of Stephen Curry that really has that in his mind in terms of being a guy who was always on the outside looking in as a younger player. Even 5 years ago, when he first stepped into the league, there were people skeptical of whether or not he could even be a real legitimate starting point guard. And here he is on his way to being a two-time MVP.
Well, the night also ended with the last game of Kobe Bryant for the LA Lakers, and he had a decent night.
Not bad. Yeah. I mean, for him to put on the kind of show he did, you know, it's really unbelievable. But it speaks to the talent and the drive of a guy who spent 20 years etching his name all over the record books in the NBA, a guy who goes down as one of the 10 all-time great players at any position in the league.
The fact that on that last night that he made 60 points, is that a bigger number or is the shooting percentage a bigger number?
In the history of the game, nobody his age walking away did it in the fashion that he did. I mean, we're talking 60 points, you know, as the oldest player in league history to score that many points in a game. Nobody will forget the championships and all of the fantastic things he did throughout his career, but there are going to be some asterisks next to Kobe's name. People talk about the shooting percentages and some of the things he dealt with off the court, but you can't deny him, you know, in terms of him being an absolutely all-time great player.
Well, he looked like he was having fun, that's for sure, and he hasn't looked like he's been having fun for years. And even though he shot 22 for 50, you know, it's a party at the end of the season.
I think a lot of that had to do with not only the fans who were in attendance and turned it into an all-day circus outside of Staples Center, but he had so many of his former teammates there, so many different guys that he played with. And even to see him embrace Shaquille O'Neal a couple times, you know, during and after the game was really something special when you consider the history those two guys had as teammates.
Well, Kobe Bryant embraces history, and the Warriors seem keen to make more history on their way to a championship. Sekou Smith, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
Sekou Smith is sports reporter and senior analyst for NBA Digital at Turner Broadcasting. Freedom of speech has been stretched and twisted by the proliferation of digital online media that use text and graphics together. It's more urgent than ever that environments make themselves more accessible to the blind and visually impaired. Facebook and all of its platforms, including Instagram and WhatsApp, have rolled out a feature that reads short descriptions of photos to blind people.
What they're looking for are people, objects, and scenes. So you might hear something like, photo may contain two people smiling. You might hear something like food, pizza, cookies, that sort of thing. And you might hear about indoors, outdoors, sky.
That's Scott Blanks, who uses the feature in his home office in San Francisco. From Facebook's point of view, it's a step to expand the number of users. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg at a major conference on Tuesday.
We stand for connecting every person, for a global community, for bringing people together, for giving all people a voice, for a free flow of ideas and culture across nations.
For now, the automatic alternative text feature is only on iPhones and in English, and the descriptions are limited. But Scott Blanks, who's a senior director of programs at San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired, has used the app for a week and says even a single word can make a difference.
One photo that really moved me, I encountered a couple of days ago. My wife shared a photo from several years back, and of course, in the past, I would have simply heard photo. And what I heard on Saturday was photo may contain ultrasound. And it was, in fact, of course, the ultrasound for our twin boys. And though it just contained that one word, it opened up a lot of memories. And, you know, my wife and I had a conversation. And of course, it wasn't something that I didn't know, but it allowed me to connect with her and reconnect with her, I suppose, in a way that maybe wasn't possible before.
Would you say there's a potential for this technology being used to hack the experience of other Facebook users?
100%. I've heard people talking about this technology, this automated alternative text technology being utilized to convey advertising, for example. I think that that's possible. Of course, we don't want this technology to be sullied, but I would say that this object recognition technology that Facebook is using is in its first stage. And it's a beautiful thing. There are many companies working on different aspects of this to identify everything from the photos in your newsfeed to what objects, people, places are around you as you travel through your world.
Do you detect that the limits in the vocabulary of the Facebook algorithm reflect some sort of moral character, some we don't want to go there kind of thing?
I wouldn't say I detect that, but I think they want to ensure this technology is accurate, that it is not misidentifying anything. There's a balance between ensuring people have better access and also we don't want to add an element of confusion. This technology is not perfect. And though the technology's vocabulary is limited, it's clear that they have started with some things that they're sure can be clearly identified that are not going to introduce a level of ambiguity into the equation. At some point, I suppose that we might get a photo caption on Facebook that said something like, three people who appear to be very intoxicated. And perhaps worse.
Okay, what are the jokes?
I think the most common thing that I've heard from some people is, wow, this is wonderful. How do I turn it off? You know, and I certainly haven't dug around to find that because it hasn't rubbed me the wrong way or bothered me yet. I'm sure that there will be more jokes as the algorithm expands to include more and more descriptions and more words. As far as I know, I haven't encountered any egregious mistakes by the technology. But of course, I guess I wouldn't know. What's also really fascinating to me about this is that I've noticed a few more people adding captions to their photos themselves. And anytime these technologies reach the mainstream and reach many people, it's always a good thing. It makes people think, ask questions, engage, and hopefully learn more about their fellow human beings.
Scott Blanks is Senior Director of Programs at San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you, John.
He's been a fixture in the U.S. Senate during the Obama era, the man with the voice a whine or so short of Cicero. 2016 marks Minority Leader Harry Reid's final year inside the Senate chamber. After three decades, enough is enough.
Listen, I know I get the mail. I see my mail. And so I know I don't make everybody happy, but I've never tried to do that. I've always tried to do what I thought was the best thing to do. And I've been under the theory that the best thing for me to do for the people of Nevada and the country is just tell people how I feel.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick caught up with Senator Reid this week to discuss his career, the election, and why he just doesn't understand the current strategy of Senate Republicans when it comes to Merrick Garland, Supreme Court Justice nominee.
I've been struck by the smiles we see around here with Republicans. They're kind of self-assured. Oh, and we're sticking together. Isn't that wonderful? It's kind of like the fish that sees the big worm in the water. He gulps that down, is so happy, but realizes shortly thereafter there's a big hook in that worm, and that doesn't work out so well. And I think that's basically what the Republicans are going to find. They can be smiling today, but this has already hurt them. It's made less competitive races more competitive, and I think they're going to lose the Senate for sure, and I think that it's going to hurt their quest for the White House. I think this is going to reverberate, as it has, through the entire society. What are they trying to hide? Why don't they do hearings? And now I know the answer. The answer is they're afraid to. Garland is a perfect candidate for the Supreme Court. Anyone could have nominated him. And I mean anyone.
What do you think has been your role in the public's perception that government has become dysfunctional? They're incredibly frustrated. They want to kill all the incumbents. Everybody has some measure of responsibility for that. What do you think yours has been, if any?
Every Congress since we became a country, there have been times when the Senate, which is a body that moves very slowly, has had problems. But the problems have all been minor compared to what happened after Obama was elected. Minor. The Republicans met after he was elected, and they met for 2 days here in Washington, all the Republican big shots, to plan a strategy, how to take this guy out, this president that they felt was illegitimate president. They decided two things. Number one, he will not be reelected. They failed that miserably. He was elected by more than 5 million votes. But their number two, they have succeeded admirably. And that is they would oppose everything and anything that Obama wanted. And they've done that. I've been here 34 years. There's never been anything like the past 7.5 years.
There's an argument, of course, that you've helped make that the Republicans nominating Donald Trump or even Ted Cruz really favors Democrats in their bid to take over the Senate. One alternate interpretation is that if all the Republican money doesn't want to support Trump, they'll pour it into Senate races and they'll pour it into congressional races, and that could actually help some of the vulnerable Republicans in this race. Do you think there's any merit to that, or do you think it's all win for Democrats in November here?
If you're Charles and David Koch and have $75 to $80 billion, they're not going to determine what they're going to spend in the Senate based upon who's the Republican they're going to be pushing for the presidency. They've been doing this for years. They're going to continue to spend to try to take over the Senate. They've done a pretty good job of taking over a lot of the country anyway. If the Koch brothers succeed, this country will turn into an oligarchy. And with Citizens United being such as it is, we continue to do nothing about that. That's where we're headed as a country.
All right, well, let me ask you about you, since you're wrapping up a long and distinguished career here in the Senate. 34 years, you mentioned, 5 terms, not running for re-election this time around. Are you sentimental about this place?
Well, I wish I could stay here till I drop dead. But I want to be remembered for my first 34 years, not my last 6. But I want everyone within the sound of my voice here today to understand what a joy it's been, an honor for me to serve in the Senate. You know, I come from a background that's you wouldn't think would prepare you for much of anything, let alone to serve as the leader of the Senate.
I read your book, The Good Fight, that you wrote a few years back, followed you for a long time. You've talked about some of the difficult parts of your life and your childhood on the Senate floor. There was substance abuse, there was suicide, and I'm not trying to dredge up too much except to say to be here at this moment when it's natural to look back is pretty remarkable.
I'll bet I'm the only senator that learned to swim in a whorehouse swimming pool, okay? But Willie Martello, he ran the biggest brothel we had in Nevada, the El Rey. He opened that place for the waifs of Searchlight for one afternoon a week, that swimming pool. That's where I learned to swim. And one time, my friend and I came over from high school, and there were some bottles out there back of his place, and we put them in the back of his vehicle to go trade them in for money. You know, that was dishonest. And he didn't do anything until he saw me the next time. And he called me, says, you know, my name was Pinky, that's what they called me. He said, I think you've got a lot on the ball. You can make a life that's going to be a good life. He said, but don't ever steal. That meant a lot to me. I learned a lot in honesty from a man who ran a whorehouse. Don't denigrate people who you think you're better than, because you can learn from anybody.
You mentioned some of the things that people say about you, and I've covered you a long time, Senator Reid. It's always occurred to me that you take a little bit of pride in your enemies, that you might enjoy a little bit the things they don't like about you.
Well, I have been somewhat envious of my friends who go through this institution and everybody kind of likes them. But I would rather be who I am. I got tremendous criticism. I said the Iraq War was lost. It was lost. It was lost. I said it because it was true. And time has proven me correct. The worst foreign policy blunder in the history of this country. Yes, I have to be candid. I think I sleep much better at night knowing that not everybody agrees with me.
Harry Reid is Senate Minority Leader and a Democrat from Nevada. He is not seeking re-election in 2016. How much is the old trumpet you have up in the attic worth? The guitar in the closet? The old viola you see every time you go to that storage space you rent? Is it time to unload it, or at least find it a new home?
The WQXR instrument drive is on. We want to put 1,000 musical instruments into the hands of New York City students.
My name is Joseph Feingold. I live in New York City.
Joseph Feingold is our donor of the day.
That's a radio spot from our sister classical station WQXR that aired here in New York. Listening to the radio was independent filmmaker Kahani Korn driving to work on 12th Avenue in Midtown.
Through WQXR, they put me in touch with Joe Feingold, who was open to meeting with me, and I knocked on his door, and I wanted to see what he was like and what the story actually was. And it was, you know, I walked out an hour later knowing that I had to follow this violin and I had to tell the story.
This story starts in Germany in 1947.
My brother and I went to the flea market. We came across the violin. So we got the violin for a carton of cigarettes. I walked the streets and I played the violin. It reminded me of my young years before the war.
Joe was a Holocaust survivor and he just wanted to play again. He did, wandering the streets, playing and grateful to have survived. But Joe's violin was back in its dusty old case when he heard the appeal on WQXR. The station manager, Graham Parker, wanted people to donate their used instruments as a way of opening opportunities for people to play who might never otherwise find the joy of playing music. Joe, in his 90s and unable to play anymore, thought there had to be someone out there who could make his violin sing again. And with filmmaker Kahani Korn documenting it all, Joe gave up his treasured violin in exchange for treasured memories from lifetimes ago.
Early life with his family in Warsaw was full of music. His mom especially was incredibly influential in his life and in handing down this love of music. He was one of three sons that they all played the violin. They all sang together. And unfortunately, as history took control of things, the family was separated and some people survived and some didn't. So that sound, and it's a testament to just the power of music, just brought him back to when life was normal and beautiful. And, you know, he kept that violin with him for the next 70 years. So at age 91, you know, got on a bus and took it to Lincoln Center on that first day of the drive and handed it over.
People who really want to learn how to play the violin from someone who loved an instrument in his early days, we can help you with that, right? At WQXR.
Absolutely.
We got that covered.
The instrument drive was, when we came up with the idea of doing this, I think what makes Joseph's story so special was just this was the exact idea we were going for, was this idea of passing a legacy from one person to the next, passing memories, passing stories, passing opportunities. I think that's what Joseph's violin represents so perfectly.
We have very exciting news to share with you all today. There's a man named Joseph, and Joseph is a Holocaust survivor. His hope is that it'll bring a similar happiness and comfort to a young life. And we are choosing one student to play on it during their time here at Big League. And the student that we have chosen, she really shows a unique ability to show her emotion through her violin. So we are so excited to announce that the student that we have chosen is Brianna.
And so you meet Brianna.
Yes.
What's that like?
She's amazing. So Brianna Perez is at the time when we were filming and when she received a violin as a 12-year-old seventh grader. She goes to the Bronx Global Learning Institute for Girls. It's in the nation's poorest congressional district. The school is spectacular. And in addition to the academic curriculum, they believe in arts and education. And so every girl who attends from kindergarten on up learn string instruments, particularly the violin. That's how they start out, and it's every single day. And so Brianna had entered as a first grader, and it's by lottery. I mean, she literally won the lottery going to this school full of so many caring teachers and administrators, and it's just in a really special place. And so she had stood out to the teachers as someone who was especially passionate about the violin, and they thought that she might be someone who could appreciate the history. And as it turned out, she more than appreciated it. It's like she feels it.
Everyone has those days where it's like dark for them, but most people find their light, and my light is playing the violin.
So at this point, you're just like, this was magic. we've struck just absolute gold here.
I mean, just I had a chance to meet Joseph. I had a chance to meet Brianna, and just to see, I was also very privileged when Kahani kind of, when they did the first meeting, when Joseph walked into the classroom to meet Brianna when she had the instrument, it was like there was not a dry eye in the house. It was a spectacular moment. This girl possesses something quite deep, and her love of music is quite profound.
As Graham just described, it was one of the most moving moments I've ever experienced. In terms of filmmaking and storytelling, I didn't know if they were going to connect or not. I hoped that they might. And the remarkable thing is when Brianna invites him to the school and he accepts her invitation and he goes and they have this afternoon together, the connection was profound and deep. And you see that it's not just him giving her something. She's giving him something as well. And it's incredibly touching.
Dear Mr. Feingold, thank you very much for donating your special violin. The first time I played on your violin, I loved the immense and gorgeous sharp sound. Was also speechless when Miss Coco called my name. Music was made a huge impact on my life. I would love to invite you to BGLID so I can meet you. I am thankful every day that I have the opportunity to play on your beautiful violin.
If any of a million circumstances had changed between 1947 and today, this story would not be told.
I feel really grateful and so excited to share the story with so many people. There's no bells and whistles in this film. It's just kind of a pure story. This small act had great ramifications that affected a lot of different people. No one more so than this now 93-year-old man and this now 13-year-old girl, who are forever connected through the power of music.
Kahani Cooperman, director of Joe's Violin, and Graham Parker, general manager of our partner station, WQXR. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
The completed short documentary, Joe's Violin, will premiere tonight here in New York as part of the Tribeca Film Festival. To see photos on the trailer for Joe's Violin, head over to thetakeaway.org. And you can take us with you. Subscribe to our podcast. Find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. A great way to stay up on the news. If you like what you hear, give us a rating. Find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcast. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.